This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Joshua Shepherd, Technical Manager of the Data Science team at Infinite Campus. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to join me, Josh.
You're welcome.
So to start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. As you said, I'm the Data Science Manager at Infinite Campus. I've been programming professionally since about 2000, and currently I am helping my company do more with both analytics and machine learning on behalf of our customers who are school districts.
What does your company, Infinite Campus, do?
So we sell software to school districts, and it covers a lot of ground, anything from grade books and attendance to parent-student portals to a product for counselors that helps predict dropout, which is our current production feature from my team.
For someone not from the United States, what does a school district mean?
Oh, that's a good question. So in most states in the United States, there are what we call kindergarten through 12th grade schools. These are generally broken up by the elementary school. So this is kindergarten through 5th grade generally. Then 6th through 8th, 9th through 12th are in high school, and each of those are separate buildings. A school district is a collection of those schools in one entity that manages itself.
So for the rest of the podcast, we're going to talk about data science and what your company is doing. But to get started, what do you mean by data science?
So data science is complicated. If you look at Wikipedia, it references a lot of different things, including analytics, scientific methods, touches on things like machine learning. For me, I use a broader version of data science. I do include analytics and machine learning. All of that kind of builds up together, but in order to even do that, there's a lot of other skills that you need.
So that leads us very nicely on to, you know, I've come across people that are saying they're data scientists, and some people say they have data science teams. Is it a multidisciplinary science at this stage, or is it an individual thing?
I think if you're just starting out, you might be able to find one individual who can put together a prototype by themselves. I will say that I am not a data scientist. I employ two data scientists at the moment. And that team is composed of a number of software engineers, test automation folks, operations folks, and data analysts. And the collection of those different individuals and different skill sets and specializations comes together to provide a data science product in a production sense.
So you mentioned a bunch of job titles there, like software engineer and the like. But what aspects of those job titles that you mentioned feed into your data science team? Because I'm a software engineer, but I'm not I'm not involved in data science.
Sure. So in order to do anything interesting with data, you first have to acquire it. And so thinking about ETL, extract, transform, load, getting data from wherever the system that it's currently in into a place where we can do something more interesting with it. Often that, you know, you might have that, somebody might call that data engineering, or depending on the size of the data, big data engineering. Getting that all together, being able to do that in a performant way, a repeatable way, those are basic, you know, kind of software engineering skill sets. Being able to work with various different data stores, whether it's relational databases or NoSQL document stores or many other different sorts that facilitate this sort of work. You also need to know statistics from a number of different levels. You need to know if something is actually significant enough to be valuable. You need to be able to look for anomalies. That kind of speaks into moves into the data analysis side. A lot of it is investigating the data sets just to even understand what you have. You may want to do something very interesting, but you may not have the data that would support it. So just even trying to understand those data sets by interrogating them, maybe doing some descriptive statistics, hard words, data visualizations. If you can't communicate the data that you have, or the summary of it to others. That's not going to be very helpful to you or anyone else. That could be a customer, or it could be to internal folks. Understanding the usage of your application and being able to characterize that as a lot or a little relative to other things is another piece that can kind of fit in the work of teams. Machine learning as a specific discipline, whether that's deep learning or not, those are kind of related but different skills. And then automation of all those pipelines, a lot of operational skill involved in all those things. But all of that kind of coming together is really what you need to be able to pull it off. There are services to help you, but if you're trying to put something together at your company, likely you're going to need those, or you're going to need to find tools that will fill the gap for you.
You mentioned data and big data as being two different things. When does data become big data?
When it starts to be challenging to work with. Entirely depends on the tool.
I mean, I'm working with a table with 29 million records. I find it challenging, but I'm pretty sure it's not big data yet.
No. So one of the tables I've got at work is around 1 billion rows in a single table using a SQL Server clustered column store index. And it works surprisingly without an amazing amount of hardware behind it. But it's not super fun, and there are other things that can do it faster. If you have to start distributing it across multiple machines, that's maybe that's big. Again, depends on your fluency and the tools that you've got, in my opinion.
No, gotcha. So you've talked quite a bit there about, what it takes to build up a data science team, but something that I've talked with friends of mine about, and I've been to some meetups, and I've never had someone explain to me, when does something become data science as opposed to I'm doing a bit of SQL and a bit of math, because I do my selects, I do my ads, I do my sums or whatever it happens to be, and that's not data science yet. So what's the threshold in your view for going from, something that's relatively simple with SQL to something that's scientific?
Well, I can say that from my experience, sometimes you need to do what I would call data analytics, data analysis, to lead into data science. And where that line crosses, some folks would kind of say, now you're into machine learning, and machine learning is the data science part. But I would push the boundary earlier than that. Honestly, SQL plus math is not a bad place to start. Again, you need to understand your data set. You need to know how common nulls are, for example. You may be trying to do something that your users are not using your product in the way that you would need them to in order to derive additional value that you can, in our case, reflect back to them. For example, if somebody's not using our gradebook, it's really hard to make any interesting claims about how students' grades affect their risk of dropout.
How would you recommend people get started on a data science project?
I would start by investigating the data sets. What data sets do you have? What are you trying to accomplish? There's probably some business problem you're trying to solve. I would recommend starting from, can you use basic statistics to solve that problem? And if you can, stop. Just do that. Getting into building models with machine learning is much more complicated. You start getting into which algorithms do you use? Are you going to use deep learning or not? But even something like linear regression can take you quite a ways until you start running into problems. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, I imagine as well, though, you probably don't need to go down the road of, let's say, programming something up in one of the statistical programming languages. You might be able, like an R or a Python, and then productizing it into a C++ for efficiency. You might be able to use something like MATLAB. Would that be fair?
For prototyping? Yeah, probably. Yeah. My team uses R primarily as our prototyping language. We use a combination of R and Python in our production tooling. Both are very capable. When we started down this road 3 years ago, there was a big question about whether or not R was going to be sufficiently robust for production. There have been a lot of tools, some from Microsoft and other companies, to help make that easier in terms of how do you even just make sure that you've got the right version of your libraries in your production setting as compared to your dev setting. That was harder to do 3 years ago in R. Python is pretty solid. You can use that in a lot of settings. That is our primary tooling right now, but we do use a lot of R, and we use them interoperably as well.
Why is it easier to prototype in R than in Python?
If you are a statistician, you are probably thinking in a way that complements how the structure of R works. If you are a software engineer, you will probably find that it's easier to do that same thing in Python, just because those languages kind of speak to that approach. So really, the prototyping is easier in any language that you have a REPL. You can quickly explore the data sets. At a conference I was at in May, I was working in F#, and that works really well.
If you were to, let's say, give a quick overview of the main tools, would the languages you've mentioned be the kind of the core ones to start with, plus a SQL database? You know, what else do you need? If I said to you, I've got, you know, 500 million records and I want to do some analysis, tell me what to download.
Sure. I would probably start with whatever data store you're most comfortable with, would be whatever to back it. In a lot of cases, and then the question of R, Python would be good places to start. I'm more familiar with Python personally, so I would start with Python. I know that you have a software engineer background, so I probably recommend Python, but I don't know your preferences for programming languages. Start there. There's a number of libraries in Python in particular that are very helpful. And just kind of getting very comfortable with, in Python, NumPy, SciPy, and Pandas are kind of three to kind of just get familiar with and kind of exploring the data sets and trying some basic things.
In the software engineering world as well, this was something I came up when I chatted with someone who was doing data science. He wasn't using any source control system. He wasn't doing any testing, anything of that nature. And I can see the face you're making. I imagine you would encourage people to start using whatever source control they want from the very start. But is something like test-driven development possible? Or not even driven, but is it possible to do unit tests in this?
Sure. Yeah, it's so anybody who's done automated testing has probably run into the situation where it's all fine up until you need data. And if what you're testing is heavily data dependent, life just got hard. When you are working with data products, in particular things that would fall under the umbrella of data science, that's your world. And that makes it very, very challenging. Some things that my team has done are baking quality checks in the form of assertions or essentially unit tests within the data processing pipeline. So they're looking for certain data conditions that would say that the data is bad or that a prior transformation step has failed. And so, you can absolutely build that in. You probably should. At each step, you're doing another transformation and then some sort of assertion to validate that that transformation worked the way that you expect it, and then go to the next step and then another test, another assertion. Lather, rinse, repeat as you build up your pipeline, because if you try and bite off too much at once, you're going to find that it's not working and you don't know how or why, and now you're debugging through steps that may take quite a long time to replicate.
But then would you also throw in some, I suppose, end-to-end tests, where you're using subsets of the data, because, you know, the data, I know you're probably going to filter the data and clean the data and so on, but you're bound to occasionally get something come true that throws a spanner in the works.
Yeah. Yeah. And so some of that's the reason why you put some of the tests in, within the pipeline, but then also when the whole pipeline works, like one of the things that we found is you say you build a model, then the next day you build a new model, you try out a new feature. One of the things you want to be able to verify is if you did the same types of predictions, with the old model, or starting with the same source data, and ran through one model and now start with that same source data and go through another model, you'd want to be able to compare the results. And, you want to know that the new model is operating differently in the way that you expect. Especially when you get into machine learning, things get complicated and it's hard to really understand all the details and implications of the changes that you might make. And at some point you're going to, well, if you're like us, you're going to having to explain how, your model works. And you can't teach them machine learning first. And trust me is not an acceptable answer. I haven't found the silver bullet for that. If anybody has that answer, I would love to talk with them.
Let's say, you know, you decide to program it with a bit of local compute, or you were saying you had your cluster of your SQL. What's available on the likes of Azure or AWS? Because I remember playing some years back with Azure machine learning. I went through the tutorial. I dragged some boxes. I didn't understand what I was doing. And then I connected up some data sets and it looked wonderful. But that was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. I imagine things have moved on and improved significantly. Not that they weren't great at the time. It was me that didn't understand.
Sure. They have and they haven't. Azure, whatever they're currently calling it, I'm looking at one of their pages right now, and they have something called Azure Machine Learning Studio, which used to be, I think it was called Data Studio, or something, Data Science Studio, something before. They've renamed a number of their tools. At one point, it was just called Machine Learning, and now it's Machine Learning Studio. It's very confusing, but there were some flow diagrams that you could put together, and you could put some Python code or R code into those little nodes within this graph, this directed graph, and that would do your pre-processing, it would do your model building, it would do your evaluation, and that's great, but there's more to it. That's like, can I do modeling at all? They have some other tools, one that they're calling Azure Machine Learning Service right now, which tries to go from building and training models all the way through deploying them. And if you are fully into the Azure ecosystem, your data is stored in Azure, you're ready to use all of their tools to build and train the models deploy the endpoints in Azure as well, then something like that could work out really well. If you are only halfway in, it will be painful. And that's been one of the challenges that my team has gone through in the recent past.
You were saying you've got a billion rows or something like that in one of your databases. If you wanted in one table. So if you wanted to get that up to the likes of Azure or AWS, is that in itself a difficult task these days, or has it become much easier?
I have not tried productionizing that. I expect it would be a challenge anytime you're moving gigabytes or terabytes of data around the internet. That's not super fun, which is part of where I was saying, you know, if you're fully into a platform like Azure, but the other clouds have equivalent products as well, you want to do your modeling near where your data already lives. Otherwise, you're paying a tax of trying to transfer that data around. If you happen to be a product that was not built for software as a service initially, and say every customer has their own database, it makes that extra challenging. pulling information together from 2,000 different databases into one place so that you can learn across them is very challenging.
Let's say we'll stick with the local installation that you've chosen. If you started small, you're probably going to stay, you know, let's say you choose to stay small for a while and you've got your model and you're happy with it, but it's not fast yet. It's not production ready. What are your steps to get it to production?
So one of the things you can do is if your data fits on your own disk, if it fits in your own workstation RAM or a VM that you can kind of keep it all well contained, that's probably best for as long as you can pull it off. If you can do that, building the model ends up being fairly small, and you can put that behind any sort of API. In that case, I'm talking about doing predictions. So you build a model, you train it on past data, and then you try and predict for future scenarios. The predictions can actually be pretty fast, but it also depends on how you set things up. I've run into a situation where trying to do them in batch was something we tried to do with Azure ML because they charge you by transaction. And so naturally, then you want to do as much work as possible in a single transaction. And then you run into timeouts, and that's painful. So then you do smaller batches, and then your transaction costs go up. You end up looking at things like retries and lag and time for VMs to warm up. So again, starting small is probably the right answer, especially for the model building piece. But it's not particularly new or interesting to stand up an API, you know, for example, a Python API. You can use Flask. We use Flask to just host our models, and it works fine. You run into scaling issues where it's single-threaded by default, and so you have to do some extra work to scale that out. Right now, we're throwing the Flask app into containers and scaling out containers behind load balancer, and that helps.
So if you do need to, let's say, scale, and you do, or maybe you need to increase the speed or reduce the CPU cycles, are there other languages that are more applicable, or is it you need better programming? What's your next step?
Honestly, I would try and look at something we've seen is, do you really need 1,000 different features in your model? You probably find that there's a lot of overlap between the different features that your model is going to try and pick off. And the fewer of those that encapsulates most of the meaning across your data set, the better. That cuts down in computation and memory and all sorts of other good things. So I would look at trimming down what you're trying to do. If you try and throw everything at it, all the possible combinations of all the possible features, you're probably wasting time and money. So looking at that, doing what's called a parameter sweep is one approach to just try and find that right cost benefit between being very sensitive to a lot of factors and being able to produce a prediction score very quickly.
You were saying earlier that one of the things that you were looking at was it the dropout rates that were of interest?
Yeah, so in the United States, the average student to counselor ratio is 400 to 1. In the state I live in, it's closer to 700 to 1. So in a perfect world, every school counselor knows all the students that they're working with. But that's really hard when you have ratios that look like that. So one of the things that we're trying to do is provide some support for those counselors to help get a sense of which students are becoming more at risk before they are heavily at risk, and so that they can kind of automate their attention, if you will. Like, who should they be working with most closely if they're not already? potentially taking it even further? And should they be working with them based on attendance or behavior or grades or stability in their household? There's a number of different kinds of things that all contribute to a student's risk of dropout based on the research that we've done and the literature in the field.
Where does that data come from? You know, obviously you have control over grades, control over attendance, but you were saying about what's happening in the household. How would you feed something like that into your model?
Sure. So my company is in the position, we are a data company. We help schools and school districts manage their data. And so for about 25 years now, we've been helping them manage their data. And that could be just enrollments. Are they free or reduced lunch students? Managing all sorts of different data for them that they need to report on to get funding, that they need to report on for various other regulations. And as it turns out, they need that data anyway for those purposes, that data can also be used to help them in other ways, like predicting dropout. Our company is interesting in the sense that we don't do advertising within the product. Our customers' data is their data. We can only use it to provide them a better product. We're reflecting their data back to them in a more valuable way.
And how has it been going so far?
It's going fairly well. We've rolled this product out to all the school districts in Kentucky, and we are actively working to confirm that our models are also going to work in other states across the country. Hopefully that's soon. We've been working hard on that for some time.
So that leads to an interesting question. Sometimes when you hear about studies that are done, whether it's, you know, to do with pharmaceuticals or medical studies, sometimes they're very specific to a region. So they would apply, let's say, because of habits in Central Europe, but not necessarily in North America. So do you face those same problems that the variables in Kentucky would be different than in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different challenges there. One is each geographic state in the United States has different regulatory requirements, which requires the schools to collect different data, and they will collect it in different ways. So the data is different, even if the meaning of the data might be similar. On top of that, there are things you might imagine are going on in different locales that some places might have early childhood stuff. Does the early childhood programs, does that help or not? There are proponents and detractors on either side for that. There's a lot of different things. You may have small districts and that are very rural. You might have large districts that are urban. Two very common patterns, but can you help learn things about students in an urban district and apply those to rural students? Sort of, but the other side is that you often need a large enough collection of data to be able to learn from, and a small school you can't learn on that in isolation. But if you can bring together many small schools together, you can look and find patterns, potentially patterns across the small schools in a state. And so those are approaches that we're looking at. But then you also have to be very careful about is your model biased for certain patterns within that? Whether there are various different protected groups, you really don't want you don't want your model reinforcing stereotypes that aren't really present in how a school operates. But if your model is picking up on certain connections that are tenuous and magnifying them, you could certainly cause problems. We are actively working to try and avoid that and have lots of automated tests specifically looking for those sorts of situations.
I have a more general question about sort of the data science and the machine learning type of things. I know some small companies that are out there maybe doing some analysis of handwriting, trying to turn it into text, or looking at images and tell, you know, that's a tree, that's a pair of glasses. how do small companies like that compete with the likes of Azure and AWS, who are pumping, you know, millions and millions of dollars plus hundreds of millions of images through models and learning systems that are probably tuning themselves? Where is, with your company, I understand you're doing something that's quite particular, and it wouldn't be, let's say, a feature that Azure would offer. But for the companies that are trying to do more general things, should they go out and buy it from Azure, or should they in some way, should they even consider a home-baked version?
So it kind of depends on what you're trying to do. If you go to conferences or meetups or things like that, and you get a panel of data science folks, and you ask them, you know, what's the most important thing, and they will all say access to data. And if you're talking about pictures, there's a lot of ways to get pictures. Now, some kinds of pictures are very particular. Maybe you can get a lot of samples of handwriting analysis, but maybe not from certain languages, for example. And so if you have a specialized set of images that nobody else has ready access to, that might be a place where you can start with something more general, some image recognition models that you can do what's called transfer learning, where you take something that knows how to recognize characters, you can add on additional layers that are specific to your use case. And so there are ways to kind of blend between what somebody can do with generally available corpuses of data and still room for those who have more specialized either needs or specialized data sets to compete in that space. But in the case of, like my company, we work with school districts. We are paid to be stewards of their data. We can't use it for anything other than to help them. We can't share it with anybody and things like that. And so because we're already in the position of being stewards of their data and all the data practices that go along with that, it's hard for someone else to replicate what we do without similar access. And so for us in our industry, we support schools with about 8 million students. Large studies in our industry are about 40,000 students. So our scale, it's hard to compete with in that case.
You have the data. You are, let's say, the Azure of that type of data.
And so finding a niche where you have, compared to your competitors, you have ready access to the data, but also being thinking about what kind of modeling you're going to do. You know, if you're doing image recognition, there are a lot of people who are working really hard on that. And you can either buy pre-trained models. There's a number of companies that will kind of get you started there. And then you can do additional training on top of that. That's a really good way to get started. There are a lot of tools that'll help you kind of stand on the shoulders of giants or take advantage of these other services. And I would highly recommend it if you have the opportunity. Don't reinvent the wheel. Don't go write the next XGBoost. You don't need to write these algorithms if you're trying to build a product. You probably want to use a tried and tested algorithm that somebody else has worked super hard to make performant, and just learn how to use that really well. Learn what it does well, learn what it falls down on, and choose the right tool off the shelf, if at all possible.
Where do you think the field is going to go over the next few years?
From what I can see, I would say there's a lot of tooling that's going to be more commoditized. Talking about these pre-trained models that will be more available either as open source type things or things that you can license from a vendor. The libraries that are available for various languages are going to be more and more accessible. For example, TensorFlow is one Python tool that's out there. People have written other tools on top of that make it more accessible. One of them is Keras. There's a new one that hit 1.0 called PyTorch. It's more Pythonic in its way of working. That is making it more accessible to do the same things that we could do before, but now more easily. So the ease of getting started once you know how to use the tools, I think is going to, that's probably where a lot of the improvement for most people will come from. But with the scale of data available for training now, the ability to throw more and more cores and specialized cores at some of these systems, that will help. But for those who are on the product side, I think the ease of adopting those tools is the piece that we're going to feel the most.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
No, other than if somebody has some way of handling how do you do automated testing heavily based on data, I would love to know more. It's really, really hard.
No, it's the same thing with general software programming, of course, because you have to exclude the data because you're unit testing, and if you're doing an end-to-end test, then you need to bring in data from some source. There are some libraries out there for C# that help, but they wouldn't help you, I'm afraid.
Well, and you can do fuzz testing and things like that to try and help generate data for you. And it's just in my career, I've not found anybody who's found a solution to that wasn't purpose built for exactly their scenario. I keep hoping that somebody's going to have a breakthrough answer to that.
Well, with that hope, Joshua Shepherd, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
If you liked this episode, you might also like episode 87 with Veronika Kleshnikova about Xamarin and cognitive services, or episode 72 with Eric Schless about fake news and how to filter it with big data, or episode 45 with Michael Kloss from Localytics about how they're using big data in their company. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Sunday Morning by Dan Yan Ki from the album Years and Years Ago.